Welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast, the podcast all about New Zealand food and drink and the people that make it happen. I'm Asher Boot, your host and owner of the ramen shop Hillside, Daisies and Bowl. Taking care of all the technical stuff is producer Steve Cochran of Rockwell Productions. On this episode, we're chatting to Frankie McPhail of Southwood Distilling. So thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
Just to start, can you give us a little bit of your background and then maybe move into how you got into distilling in general?
Yeah. I actually have listened to a couple of your guys' podcasts, and I hear all these great stories from people about how they've been in the restaurant industry and working into wine. And my background actually was in working at a garden center in retail.
Cool.
So I worked in retail for a activewear company. And I decided one day, I looked around my store, I was like, okay, I'm sick of putting people in yoga pants. If I could take all the yoga pants out of my store and replace it with something, what would it be? And I decided it would be whiskey bottles. Take that back probably about 8 years when I was home from university in the summer working in a bar. A lovely barfly asked me on a date. I said yes. He took me to my very first whiskey bar.
Yep.
We went upstairs, had some food, and downstairs there was Highland Dancing. There were drams. I had never had whiskey straight other than at a bar in college. And I asked if I was going to have it with some ginger beer or some Coke. He said, absolutely not. And so I took my first sip of whiskey straight, beautiful. I'm pretty sure it was an Islay Smoky whiskey. And that was it.
Yeah.
I was hooked. So moved out of retail. Kept working it in the background to kind of fund my dream. But I decided if I could do anything in the world, I had a bit of a life crisis, went down to Malthouse, ordered a whiskey, decided, all right, this is your chance. If you can do anything that you want, what's it going to be? Decided it was going to be making whiskey. I had no idea how to make whiskey. I knew it was delicious. Yeah. I also failed math and science through high school and university.
Yep, that's great for distilling.
Also an assistant manager living on my own in Wellington, $0. So went home on the 24 bus, Googled, how do you make whiskey? Proceeded to have my first breakdown that how am I ever going to do this? I don't know anything, but it looks really cool. And there was just something in the cards in the universe where I was hooked. Everything I read, everything I tasted, it just expanded my palate and my knowledge and my curiosity more. Mm. The distillers, the barrels, the stories. So I just started learning in the background. I started trying to find where I could go get educated on it. It was either move to Scotland or stay here with my partner that I had just met. I said, I'll stay here, but we're starting a distillery. So I took second jobs in liquor stores. I did all the online seminars that I could. So my journey into distilling and gin and whiskey was kind of just an obsession,
yeah.
An obsessive passion that I've turned into living my dream every day.
That's fantastic. I always find that really fascinating. I see it so often, people who have subjects at school that never interest them or never appeal at all, and then end up in an industry that relies so heavily on those subjects. But it's finding that drive.
Yeah.
You know, it's discovering it and then pushing from there. You know, there's something can flick a switch. And I think that's actually a really cool message just in general. Like, hey, don't let it hold you back. There's, you know, it's just finding the drive that makes you want to learn is the difference.
Yeah, absolutely. In college, I played ice hockey at university. That's predominantly why I was there.
Yeah.
I did some marketing and communications in the background. But when I looked at the science majors and the chemical engineers and the engineering girls, I was like, whoa, no. And now sometimes I look at myself and putting clamps and valves on and working air pumps and propeller pumps. And I think if I could only tell myself 10 years ago, you would be looking at spaces and dreaming of a forklift.
Yeah.
She'd think you were fucking nuts.
Yeah. That's great. That's cool. So, I mean, whiskey was the driver. How did that turn into gin?
So we pursued starting our distillery. We're up at the top of Cuba Street right now. But before that, we were looking for a space, dreamed of barrels, dreamed of two beautiful stills. But whiskey takes a long time to make. So it has to go down for a minimum of 2 to 3 years. Even then, depending on your climate and environment, it's not necessarily ready. And you can imagine that takes a lot of cash, which we did not have. We're scrappy. We're rugged. We are in this because we love it. So we ended up having a meeting with someone that we potentially were going to partner with. And he said to me, we should do gin. We should make gin. We can bottle it. We can put it out. It's very trendy. And I kid you not, I went home with my partner and broke down in tears and had the biggest drama queen fit about making gin. There's no whiskey. There's no barrels. It's just London, Bombay. What am I going to make gin? He told me to grow the fuck up. That's legit what he said to me. He said, if you want to make the dream work, like you got to do some other thing. So I had a very long talk to myself that night and decided if I was going to do this gin thing, I wanted to go for broke. I wanted to do it the way I want. I wanted it to be bigger, bolder. I wanted it to be gin that, as a whiskey drinker, I would drink. Mm. And that's when I started kind of diving into the world of gin and seeing that it's not just London, Bombay, Gordon's, Tanqueray, that bad night in high school on gin. It's actually quite agile and fun, and you can really push it. And so that started me down the wormhole of, okay, I'm going to make gin, I'm going to do it my way, and I'm going to love it.
So do you have any little, you know, barrels hidden away somewhere at the moment that is still your sort of whiskey thing? Is that happening, or is there any?
Yes, yeah. It is. So we don't have any of our whiskey barrels officially down yet as a distillery.
Yeah.
I do have my home brew whiskey down. Cool. So I've actually had my first whiskey come of age this past November, hiding somewhere in my house. That's pretty good. Pretty good. The wood does a lot of the work, the heavy lifting.
Absolutely.
But we bought our first two barrels about 3 weeks ago from Dry River over in Martinborough.
Yep.
So a Syrah barrel and a Tempranillo.
Oh, cool.
And so those are the first two barrels that we're going to go into.
Yeah.
And we're actually doing our first test wash this coming Tuesday.
Cool.
So it's exciting. Yeah, it's very exciting.
Wicked.
Only cool. Like 4 years to wait.
Yeah. Hey, I want to talk about, because you talked about the agileness of gin and layman here.
Yes.
I assume a lot of that comes down to the use of botanicals through the process. Can you walk us through, though, making gin? What's the, you know, give us a step-by-step how to make a bottle of gin.
Absolutely. So I'll start from when you get the base spirit, because making the base spirit is a whole nother kettle of fish. Yep. But for what we're talking about, you essentially have a base spirit or a neutral alcohol. In a very rough term, you're starting with a vodka. So you're starting with something that has no flavor, and that's what you want, because the botanicals that you put in it, you want the botanicals to shine. You don't want any of that alcohol flavor at the end. So you take your base spirit, you take juniper, which is the most important ingredient in gin, has to be a predominantly juniper flavor for it to be considered gin. And I do that with air quotes because things are kind of changing these days. So juniper is your number one most important. Coriander seeds, your second most important. And citrus is essentially, for a broad spectrum, the top three things you need to make your gin. Mm. So there's a couple different ways you can do it. You can take your base spirit and then take all those beautiful botanicals and put them in to macerate or steep overnight. So essentially, like, you're making a really nice, strong alcoholic tea. The next day you come in, when you turn on your still, all those flavors will be imparted in that mix. And because alcohol has a lower boiling point than water, so that alcohol will boil out first, all those flavors are going to be in that alcohol and coming up through your still.
Mm-hmm.
The other way that you can do it is you can take those beautiful botanicals and put them into your botanical basket. So what that means is you would turn your still on, alcohol would boil off first, and then the steam would pass through your botanicals.
Okay.
So it's picking up those flavors as it goes through. So they're more light, more delicate. Essentially, you'd have to pack your botanicals still with 3 to 5 times the amount of botanicals you'd use in your pot to get a similar flavor, because they're done in two different methods.
You know, I'm a chef by trade and I'm thinking about infusions and things like that. I know infusing cold gives me, from a food perspective, a more pure flavor.
Yeah.
Is that the same? You know, soaking the botanicals in the base spirit as opposed to passing the steam through the basket?
Yeah. So there is, it just creates different flavors. Mm. And you can dive as deep into, like, if you're macerating them in, say, a 90% strong ethanol or alcohol, and then you add water in the next day to turn it on. Or if you macerate your botanicals in, say, 43% alcohol overnight, you'll get different flavor variations.
Yeah.
Or if you steep hot or cold, you can essentially freeze steep some stuff and then let it out. The temperature will vary. That's probably one of the things that's open on my phone right now, is cold steeping and cold pressing and rabbit holes. So it will change. And with the vapor as well, obviously your vapor is already always going to go through hot.
Mm-hmm.
That's always pretty straight up. But depending on your botanicals, your juniper berries, your orange peels, your licorice, your roots kind of stuff, that's more hardy stuff that can handle it.
Mm.
Whereas stuff like sugar kelps, rose petals, if you're working with anything floral, if you're going to boil it in the pot, it's very aggressive and hard on it.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a balance on where you're putting stuff as well.
And is there any cases where you do both?
Yes.
Yeah.
So we do both. Cool. How our still is designed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of different ways you can distill as well. So there's pot distilling, which is one pass, very full, keeps the flavors, and that's what all our gins are done on. Mm-hmm. And then there's also reflux distilling or stripping, where you pass it through different chambers and it strips back the alcohol. So if it goes in the bottom at 60, it could go 65, 70, 75. So it's going to strip flavor and alcohol.
Fascinating.
Oh, tell me about it.
And then getting into botanicals, I mean, yeah, you've got those base ones you talked about, your coriander, juniper, and citrus.
Yes.
What drives the others? Like, what makes you think of going in other directions? And you know, I think hearing rose petals, that's a very different profile.
Yeah.
To almost anything. That floral profile is such an incredibly strong thing. I mean, you've done, sitting in front of us, we've got maple, we've got chili, we've got smoked rosemary. You know, those are some pretty unique flavors that you don't see in gin bottles a lot. So what's the driver behind doing that, and what's the thought process that goes into these?
Yeah, so I can only really speak for Southward Distilling and what I see of the industry, but I guess it depends what you're trying to create. So if you're going for something like a classic London dry, you're going to stick pretty basic. So juniper, coriander seed, lemon peel, licorice root, orris root, almonds. So you're sticking to stuff that has a pretty dry, familiar palate.
Yep.
Now, if you're someone like me who wants to do stuff differently, because love everyone who's doing London Dry, but a lot of people are. So then you start to explore, okay, if I want a smoky flavor, what botanical will give me that smoky flavor and impart it into my gin? But the thing that's cool, and you can appreciate this with cooking, is you have black cardamom in front of you, but when you distill it, it's not going to taste like it smells and tastes in front of you. So it really much is like cooking. If I'm going to use black cardamom, what do I want to balance that with? Something grounding, something woody, something sweet, something spicy. So it's a matter of building out what kind of gin are you trying to create. Mm. And so for me, being a whiskey drinker, first and foremost, I know that if you walk into a liquor store or into a bar and you say, I want a smoky whiskey, I want a smooth whiskey, I want a buttery whiskey, there's so many different categories and terroirs and areas they can pick for you. Whereas with gin, if you walk into a bar or a liquor store, they're essentially going to give you a ginny gin.
Yeah.
There's no savory, there's no spicy, there's no sweet, but everyone tastes differently, just like we see colors differently. And so that's where, with Southward Distilling, I wanted to really play with those flavors. So if you come to us, you can still have the different, or if you're drinking our gin, you can still have that experience of playing to your palate, but in different ways. So when people are sitting at one of our tastings and they're all tasting a spicy gin and someone doesn't like it and someone does, that's like what I love.
Yeah.
Because that's how it's supposed to be. So in terms of creating a whiskey, it all depends on what you want the drinker to be experiencing at the end for me.
Yeah.
And kind of pushing the boundaries until people tell me I've gone too far.
How immediate is gin in terms of the product that you are going to want someone to drink?
Yeah.
Does it need time to sit and develop, or straight away, or what's the deal there?
So you can do it in about 72 hours.
Yeah.
But after you distill it, so a distilling run will take anywhere when you turn on the still from 6 to 12 hours, depending what you're distilling. If you're macerating it, you put it down the night before. But when it comes off the still, you technically could water it down and put it into a bottle right away. It's ready to go. But what you want to do is, because it's such a chemical process, is you do want to leave it to sit. And then all those really lovely esters and flavors get to mix together and become one thing, as opposed to your run being a couple different chapters.
Yep.
And then what you do is you proof it down with water. So for anyone listening, if you don't know alcohol, what you drink is not what comes off the still. So it will come off the still at anywhere from 70% up to 90% alcohol by volume. Tastes delicious just the same. And then you proof it down with water. So you essentially add water to it to bring it down to what we drink at anywhere from a 40% to a 50%. And when you add that water, same thing. It's a chemical reaction happening. The water is diluting down the alcohol. So you want to leave it. And the best time is to leave it overnight so it proofs properly.
Water. In so many things, water is hugely underestimated in the influence that it has.
Yes.
Because a distilled water tastes different to a tap water or a spring water. Or what are you looking for there? And are there issues with the chemical, like mineral makeup of water and adding it to gin?
There is, depending where you are. It's more prevalent in brewing. So the pH level is more prevalent in what you're doing in brewing or if you're mashing, as opposed to the end process of what we're doing. But that being said, water is so important because it can completely change a spirit. Mm. Not all the water we drink is the same. If I taste water in Canada from a glacier, it's different from the water here dug down in a borehole. And I think water is hugely underestimated in distilling because we add it, but how much are we putting into where it comes from, what's in it? For us, particularly, we are an urban distillery. And although urban distilleries are a sexy dream, we're in the city, water is a nightmare. Yep. I asked if we could dig a borehole in the middle of Cuba Street. They said no. I don't know why. So for us, ours passes through a filter because water is life, both for the brewery and for us. But that being said, in the future, I'd love to play with different waters. Mm. When you're mixing it to the spirit, like I said, it does have an effect and can change it ever so slightly. The main problem that distillers and craft distillers will find, and craft distillers, if you're listening, this is okay, is it's called louching. And it's when you add water to your gin and it goes cloudy. Mm. And that is not market friendly gin in terms of how we are now. But there was also a time when hazy beer wasn't market friendly beer. Okay. So what happens is because of all those oils in the gin, when the water is added to it, mainly from the juniper, it creates a very cloudy, milky looking gin. And it doesn't necessarily mean that anything's wrong with it. It's just there's so much flavor in there that it is causing a chemical reaction.
So it's just the emulsion of the oils into the water.
Exactly. Yep. Cool. So that's when it comes down to water. Actually, yesterday when it was hailing, I'm not kidding you, I went and I took a bucket from the still mid-hail. You can ask the brewer, this is true stories. And I put it out in the hail because I was like, what if I cut down some of my gin with hail water? Would that taste different? Well, when it melts down. But I was at the end of the hailstorm. I didn't get enough. There was some guy in the bar too. He looked at me like I was nuts because I was yelling out about hail gin. And
yeah. Just going back to that base spirit. I mean, I know of grain spirit and whey spirits. What's the difference there? And does that make a big difference to your gin?
Yes.
Cool.
I think so. And again, these are just my opinions on it, is that there's a couple different things you can make your base spirit from. You can go grain, like you said. You can go whey, which is a byproduct of milk. You can go grapes, and you can also go sugar. So you can make a sugar wash, essentially. Sugar washes and whey and grapes are not essentially good for whiskey because you're not going to get the flavor profile that you need for the wood to pick up what it needs. If you're designing your gin, you're looking at a bunch of different things if you're starting a distillery, and that's cost as well. Whey is relatively cheap for the stuff that we're doing. Sugar wash is probably second to that. Grapes, very expensive and very process heavy. And then for me, again, being a whiskey girl, grain to me is the ultimate.
Yeah.
I think because it has a very full, round flavor that when it's redistilled, it complements what botanicals can do in it. Whey for me is very light and it's a bit artificial, a bit metallic-y. Grapes I think are absolutely beautiful, but again, super process heavy. You're going down the brandy route that way.
Yeah.
And then sugar wash, it's a really easy thing to do, but it's very sweet. So it all depends what kind of gin you're going to make in the end and what the profile of your spirits are. And I think a lot of times people don't consider what that base is. It's like, oh, okay, I can get way, it's really easy, I'll put it in, I'm just going to run with that. Whereas you might not have explored what the grain element can do or anything like that. It's almost like juniper berries as well. They come from so many different places in the world.
Yeah.
They're like grain. So using juniper berries from different areas and different origins can completely change.
The terroir of spice is hugely underestimated, I think.
Blows my mind.
I notice it a lot. Yeah, cooking, again, relating these two things. But you can really notice when spices come from different regions.
Absolutely. You can even notice when base spirit, for me, I know base spirit in Canada tastes different from base spirit in New Zealand.
Yeah.
Because different grain. For me, one thing that totally blew my mind is when I taste bread and cheese and butter at home in Canada, it tastes completely different to what it does here.
Yeah.
And so stuff growing all over the world creates completely different profiles.
Mm. Where do you get juniper from? Is there a consistent source of a juniper that is consistent enough for your liking?
Yes, at the moment. So right now, our juniper comes from Macedonia. Mm. A lot of New Zealand distilleries order theirs from the Mediterranean at the moment. And that's because we don't grow it in a commercially viable amount now. They're beautiful bushes in your front yard, but we aren't actually at the point where we can have commercially grown juniper in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So there's a distillery up north, Juno Gin, The two lovely people that run that are working with Massey University to find juniper in New Zealand that we can actually turn into a commercially viable crop for the growing gin industry. And for them, it started out because it kind of brings everything full circle for us to get it from the Mediterranean and bring it over here. Affects the environment. Whereas if we can grow it here, it kind of brings everything full circle to what we can do. But unlike other plants, juniper plants need a male and a female because they each grow their own cones. So what they're doing right now is looking for those male and female plants in people's backyards or getting other people to look for them, the great juniper hunt, so that we can start to grow a juniper crop here.
Fascinating. Okay, we've made the gin.
Yes.
Now drinking it. Is a gin and tonic the bane of a distiller's life?
Oh, when we opened the distillery, I tell you what, we had our first cellar door and we launched grapefruit gin, blueberry gin, and smoked rosemary gin. And every single person asked me, what tonic would you drink with? And that was the bane of my fucking life because I like ginger ale. I grew up in Canada, dirty rye and gingers. Mm. That's what I'm mixing something with. Gin and tonics to me were just, why do we have to drink gin with one thing?
Yeah.
So for some distillers, it might be like the best part of their existence. For me, because if you can tell, I'm a little bit different. We have beautiful tonics out there to go with stuff, but there's so much else you can drink with it and do with it too.
Mm.
So it's not the bane of my existence, but it's pretty close.
So sipping gin?
Okay. Yes. Oh, glad you brought that up because it's kind of, gin is coming into a new era. Before, 2 years ago, you wouldn't walk into a bar and ask for a local gin on the rocks or ask for it neat so you can taste it before it goes in your gin and tonic. Before, they would make you your G&T instead of bringing you the bottle of tonic and the G so you can mix them and combine them how you want. We are now just starting to step into a stage, and we're still a couple of years off of it being the norm, where there are sipping gins.
Mm.
And I think New Zealand is really a forefront for that in creating big, bold gins that have flavor and not trying to be too dry to hide in a gin and tonic. So it's not the norm yet. But like you said, in front of us, we have a maple gin and a smoked rosemary gin that are both really deep and rich in color and stand alone on their flavor. So you could enjoy those two over ice.
Yeah.
And just neat.
Yeah. And what about other mixes then? I mean, you've talked about ginger, but there are any other particular things that you feel naturally go with your gins? Depending on which gin it is.
Yeah, it depends on which gin. Soda water is really great. I think over in North America, they're kind of a couple years ahead of us on the soda water game.
Yeah.
And it becoming like the tonic water game where I've seen juniper berry soda water.
Okay.
Straight up. And there's a couple breweries that are now making not necessarily hard sodas, but the soda waters to go with a hard soda. So that I think is a really exciting thing for us to get into. But for me, I love ginger. Ginger ale, ginger beer, I think the flavors of it are really underestimated in how it can complement different tonics, different gins and different whiskeys as well.
Yeah.
So that's my go-to.
Cool. You do a bit of a, you know, people can tour your distillery, but also this idea of mixing your own botanicals and making a gin and all that. Like, how does that go? Because there is a risk, obviously, in letting people kind of go nuts and mix all sorts of things. Like, do you get some cool results? Or
Yeah. The people I love the best who come in and just go hell for leather and just throw like everything in.
Yeah.
Because there is a certain style of gin making class you can do where you're very guided.
Yeah.
That's not ours.
Yeah.
Everyone's coming in to choose their own adventure. So first they taste four of our gins to get an idea of what style. So when then they're a little bit buzzed and a little bit more loose, we let them loose on the botanicals. And a lot of these botanicals people haven't seen in the raw form.
Mm.
I can tell you that licorice root is in your gin, but you're going to picture this black, gummy, sweet thing.
It's completely different.
Nah, it's beautiful. It's sweet. It's woody. And people are blown away by it. So when they come in to do it, you get some real interesting results. How much juniper people are putting in, how little juniper. And everyone gets really like, the first thing that happens, about 3/4 of people are like, what's the math? What's the math? What do I do? And then you're just like, just chill.
Yeah.
Just chill, just throw stuff in, a pinch of this, a handful of that. And by the time we build them in these little glasses, like the glasses are just packed to the brim with different things. But the cool thing about it and why I wanted to do it originally is what I said about palates is none of us taste the same.
Yeah.
So if you're going to want smoky, sweet, how many opportunities are you going to get to go in and put together your botanicals and then have something? So what they do is they put it together, they leave it with us, and we redistill it for them.
Yeah.
So it's basically like your own custom gin.
Mm.
And we have a lot of home distillers come in as well, because I know that when I was starting, there's two things you Google if you're going to decide to start a distillery. Number one, where the fuck do I get my still if I don't have all the money to get a nice German one? Because much like a German car, they cost a lot of money. And number two, how much juniper do I put in my gin?
Yeah.
And then kind of building back from that. So you get people coming to you asking all these really finicky questions about what do we do? And you kind of just get to show them that, look, you're in the driver's seat. And with the drinking side of things, as opposed to the home distilling, people start to learn what they like to taste.
Yeah.
Oh, this is what sugar kelp is. It's not actually fishy and salty when you're done distilling it. This is what pink peppercorn is. And so hopefully they'll then go to the liquor store and know, oh, hey, I'm looking for something with this in it. Sorry to the guys at the liquor store, because that's probably going to be a really long conversation for you. So yeah, it's cool getting people kind of educated through entertainment to start drinking and knowing what they're drinking.
No, that's really, I know I was speaking to the team from the Rolling Mill, Nick and V, and they had a great time.
They were the first people as a group to come in and do it.
Yeah.
And Nick, he was the first person to go hell for leather. He just built a hay bale in his cup. He was like, is that too much? That's the other thing is that if people put too much in their cup, it's their own adventure, right? Yeah. I'm not choosing it for them. So if it's bad, it's not my problem.
Awesome. Hey, I'm being Wellington and how the Wellington sort of drink and food scene tends to work. Collaborations.
Yes.
What have you been up to? Who have you been working with?
Oh, with Wellington on Plate coming up, we have 3 custom gins in the work at the moment. So going back to me getting into distilling, I worked for that yoga wear company and I did community for them. And one thing that I realized about Wellington that was really cool is Wellington is a town disguised as a city. Yeah. And it's kind of like Disney World when you come here. It's so small. You can walk around. You can go on all the rides. You can eat all the food. But it has a real story underlying to it. So what Apache is making isn't the same as what Logan Brown is making. It's not the same as what you guys are doing in your restaurants. Mm. And every restaurant and bar has their own story. So that doesn't mean that there's a one-size gin fits all. So I wanted to be a very agile distillery where if you wanted a custom gin for your bar, we could do it and pull it off, work together and find out how we could tell your story better.
Mm.
And those are the gins that are really work heavy because there's a lot involved in how we design it and develop it to really suit that story of the restaurant or bar or person, but they're really exciting.
Cool.
So right now we have a collaboration with Raglan Roast. So we have a coffee gin coming out that we've done with their Brown Lightning.
Yep.
Which is really exciting. We have a coffee and banana gin coming out with Cuckoo for Wellington on a Plate. Aaron, the bartender there, he helped me design Negroni gin. He came to me, he said, I want a coffee gin with banana.
Yeah.
And I just, bananas are a nightmare to work with.
Yeah.
Gooey, mushy, but we've pulled it off,
cool.
I think. So their Southside Cartel has that in it. We also have a smoked green tea gin coming out for Shepherd for Wellington on a Plate.
Nice.
So those are the two kind of really unique ones we have
on
the cards in terms of collaboration at the moment.
Cool. That sounds exciting.
Yeah.
Is that a fun process?
Yes.
Because you have that outside influence, right? Like a creative brain will go in all sorts of directions.
Yeah.
But then someone else's idea will throw it into a whole new place as well.
Oh, and you become a storyteller. So I love stories. So there is obviously a real science underneath the charm of distilling, which I'm still learning as I go every day. But that charm for me and that story is I almost take myself out of running my business and try and like get into yours. So what is the story of your restaurant being an entrepreneur? How did you get here? What is your restaurant trying to tell when people come in there? Could be something really simple. It could be more intricate and complicated and seasonal. So it's how do you kind of translate what you want and what would match your menu into a gin with different botanicals and methods and tastes and flavors. So it's one of the funnest parts of owning a distillery.
Oh, that's great. Hey, New Zealand's got quite unique laws around distilling your own spirits and things like that. The fact that you are allowed to do it at home. So does that make getting into distilling in general a lot easier?
It does in a certain way. It's kind of like home brewing.
Mm.
So if you wanted to brew at home, you can do it.
Yeah.
If you want to distill at home, anyone out there, you can do it as long as you get the right equipment and take the right safety precautions. To take that to the next level is a little bit more cost heavy and a little more time inducive. But for people to have access to that at home, is really unique because we're the only Western country, one of the only countries where you can legally distill at home. And so that allows for a lot of great things to happen and a lot of really bad things to happen. Like when I started home distilling, there was a lot of nasty stuff.
Yeah.
At the time, tasted great. But now I taste back on it. Oh, there was wrong stuff going on. So New Zealand is unique in that way. And it's a real pathway to, okay, I'm doing this at home. I'm enjoying it. Is this a passion? Is this something I want to take to the next level?
Mm.
But at the same time, it's a really interesting point for New Zealand spirits too when that starts to happen.
Yeah.
So everyone's distilling at home. Some people are enjoying it. Next level. There's so many people that can go out and start a distillery with the right money and resources. And we're such a small place.
Yeah.
You're going to have a lot of bad stuff and a lot of good stuff. And we're at the point now where we're seeing that all come to market in fruition. And we still have a couple years, decades before we weed out, okay, what's our real taste? What's our real mark?
It is
the world.
Always an interesting thing because you, when you get that first flooded market, and it happens with so many things,
yeah,
the quality doesn't have as much effect as you'd want it to have.
Yeah,
it takes a while for that to filter through.
Yeah,
which can be detrimental.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah,
which is got its challenges. What other sort of challenges have you encountered or seen in getting a distillery up and running?
It's a lot around regulation with just health and safety, just getting everything on an even playing field.
Yeah.
These are the regulations. This is how you do it, where you can go to different regions of New Zealand and you'll get all different answers on how distilleries are built and regulated and health and safe and that kind of stuff. So it's doing your due diligence and your research and reaching out to the right people. But I think that's the hardest part is just, this is what we're doing. It's distilling. It's safe. We'll make it safe. It's not a bomb.
Yeah.
I know in Canada, people literally see it as a bomb that can go off at any time. But it's just like brewing.
Yeah.
As long as you're doing it safely and you know what you're doing, that's the way to do it.
Does distilling, craft distilling as you've called it, encounter the same problem that a lot of industries do where the craft side is being treated from the regulatory body in the same way as mass generic production is, and following those financially becomes incredibly challenging?
Yes. And I think that's kind of what we were talking about earlier in terms of regulation on tax is that we are still taxed to the percentage that our gin is. So if I make a 50% gin or a 50.1% gin, it changes how much tax I'm going to pay.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people don't know how much, unless you're a brewer in the wine industry, how much liquor tax we actually pay on it.
Yeah.
I'm not doing this to get rich. I'm doing it because I like making booze. So I think that kind of limits it. Because you could release some really amazing banging gins that are 50%, just below 50%, but they're actually going to cost more to make than they are to sell.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. So I guess that kind of holds you back. The one thing that is really good about New Zealand is in terms of the regulation of taking something to market, it's pretty easy.
Yeah.
Compared to other places in the world. So as I was saying earlier, Ontario, Canada, with the Liquor Control Board, there's only one chain of liquor stores controlled by the government. It takes anywhere from 2 to 3 years just to get something on the shelf. And craft distilleries over there, they can actually only have one bottle per category, one gin, one vodka, one whiskey.
Yeah.
But that's for the craft distillers. For the guys like Smirnoff or Absolut.
They can have whatever they want.
They can have whatever they want.
That's always fun.
Whereas here, if we make something that's really cool and we take it to regional wines and spirits around the corner, boom, it's on the shelf. So that's one thing that's really cool about New Zealand. It's just getting through those regulations so that we can start to create some really cool stuff and get a bit of tax break so we have that room to play, be creative.
That just made me think of something. What's gin without juniper? Is it just flavored vodka?
Oh, another great question.
Or is it something else?
Well, technically it's flavored vodka.
Yeah.
But that's the cool thing about where spirits are. So before we had everything in like these really traditional categories. A gin has juniper. A vodka is clean. Whiskey is bourbon or scotch or brandy is brandy. And you're trying to make things to fit into these categories. Whereas like you just said, if I make something that's fermented strawberries in a vodka base with a little bit of juniper, but it's not the predominant flavor, what is that?
Yeah.
Or if I start playing with different things.
Sounds delicious.
Right? It's so experimental. Like technically some of our gins aren't gins because juniper isn't the predominant flavor.
Yeah.
Smoked rosemary gin.
Yeah, that's always going to be a stronger flavor than anything else.
Yeah. So you're seeing this really unique turning point in the world where especially places in Scandinavia, in the Netherlands, I believe it is, they're really starting to push it.
Mm.
Like, I'm just going to release a spirit.
Yeah.
It's made from agave, but it's not a tequila. It's not aged. It's whiskey, but it's not. And that is probably the most exciting category is white whiskey.
Yeah.
It has to be in a barrel for a minimum 3 years to be called whiskey. But when it comes off the still, it's freaking beautiful.
It's also surprisingly popular.
White whiskey?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, it's basically moonshine, right? Like,
yeah,
you know,
that's what it is.
Yeah, and it will sell. I mean, I know I've got it on restaurant lists, and yeah, it always surprised me that people are really keen to.
Yeah, and the only difference is that what I would come off my still is my white whiskey. Mm. I can then put back in my still and make gin out of it, but you put some juniper in it and people are like, okay, now I'll drink it.
Yeah.
And I think it's just that education thing on moonshine. You think of someone in the mountains, in overalls, backyard hillbilly making moonshine, but when it comes off the still, it's this beautiful, grainy, full, sweet liquid that's real good.
That's fascinating. It really is.
Yeah.
You were talking earlier before we started recording about a New Zealand flavor coming through in gins. Yeah. Can you talk about that a bit more now that we're recording you?
Yeah, it's really unique. I think, like I said, the New Zealand spirit industry or craze is not even in its like infant stage. It's still pre-first-term pregnancy, just starting to be born. So as gins start to come on, what I'm starting to see is a really unique style of New Zealand gin, and that's going into that more New World style, which is bigger, bolder, not as dry as a London style that we're used to. And you're getting these really unique notes as well. So Roots down in South Island is using gross flour and hops. We use a bit of hops as well in our new experimental stuff. Kawakawa, Pine, Reefton, Little Bitty down in the South Coast, they're packing their still full of everything in the forest that their foragers can find.
Yeah.
So you're getting this really bold style of gin that stands out in a gin and tonic. But because everything is from New Zealand, there's this underlying boldness, and that's the best way I can describe it, this bold kind of subtle sweetness that's really coming through and familiar.
Mm.
And I think it's really becoming a beacon of what a New Zealand gin is. Because if you went and entered your gins into a London spirits category or New York, you're not going to have a New Zealand style of gin category.
Yeah.
But the more that come to market, the more you see, okay, this is us.
Yeah.
This is us on a world stage.
Do you think that's to do with the number eight wire approach in New Zealand in general of creating something out of what you've got?
Yeah. You work with what you have and you put in and you kind of go, like I said, hell for leather, and you're going to do it your way, calculated or not.
And maybe that ease of access to market helps with that as well.
That's the second thing I was going to say. If you want to create a really bold gin and take it to market, you can put it there. And if it doesn't work, you can change it. But you can kind of go bigger and bolder and not have the regulations around ingredients like, say, North America does, like we've been talking about. So in BC, for example, in Canada, for a craft distillery to go to market and get a tax break, every single thing in that bottle has to be made from a BC ingredient.
Mm.
So from the grain, everything up. And as a small player, getting that tax break is huge for them.
Yeah.
Whereas if you choose to go from an imported base alcohol, you then have to pay more taxes, but you can produce a lot more, a lot quicker.
Mm.
And we don't have that here. So we see that we're creating this bold style of gin because we can and because the Kiwi palate is really liking it and they keep buying it.
Cool. Future plans. What's going on?
Whiskey.
Whiskey. Yeah. That's cool. So, in that then, I mean, when you're talking about whiskey, are we talking like New Zealand grown maize and rye and barley being part of that or?
Oh, absolutely. So this is my favorite. This is whiskey spiel. I give this to everyone that's come through my distillery is that, much like gin is growing in New Zealand, gin is a global thing right now, and whiskey is as well. But whiskey is so unique because nothing but time can really elevate that whiskey to being what it is and showcasing where it's from.
Yeah.
And the New Zealand whiskey industry as it grows, I think, is going to be a huge player.
Mm.
And I'm talking 20, 30, 40 years down the road. So what's next for us is getting involved in that. And when you look at what we have naturally here to offer as New Zealand in terms of the grain, in terms of wood, in terms of the water source, like you have all these really amazing things. And the craft beer industry leads into that as well because you have these brewers that have knowledge to make a really amazing wash and mash to turn it into something even better. And if you look at how New Zealand is shaped and you look at Japan and Scotland and Tasmania, we're built
yeah.
to make whiskey. So
not only to make whiskey, to have the definite regions of whiskey as well.
Absolutely. Like if we made a whiskey down in Dunedin, it's not going to taste the same as a whiskey in Wellington or a whiskey in Hawke's Bay.
Yeah.
And that's the coolest part. And even if you make the whiskey from different grains in different areas, this is when I really get excited. This is when it's going to come across.
Yeah.
So for example, Wellington, as far as I know, no one has put down whiskey here yet.
Yeah.
But if you look at us and you look at our environment and our climate, and when we get that southerly blow through, can you imagine having barrels out on the south coast and really like in Scotland, taking that weather and having the barrels expand and contract and what it would do to them in the atmospheric pressure?
Yeah.
Plus you get grain from down at Gladfield, some beautiful rye that here, it's not as spicy, it's a little bit more sweet. Combine it with the maize, like I just think it's going to be...
Cool. That's exciting. That gets me exciting. Hey, where can people buy your gin and where do they find out more about the making your own botanical mix and getting involved in that?
So you can go to our website, southworddistilling.com, and that has all of our tours and tastings. It also has our gin club that you can sign up for. So if we release something like a hop gin or a green tea gin, and we make a small batch of it, Gin Club gets access to it first. Cool. We've had instances where it doesn't even make it out of the office because Gin Club has bought it. You can buy our gins over the bar at Heyday, as well as regional wines and spirits and more Wilsons in town. And you can sign up for all of our Blend Your Own sessions on the website for our tours. We have some really cool events coming up over summer. We have a cocktail degustation. We also have a cheese donut pairing with our gins coming up because I like cheese and donuts.
Awesome.
Why else would you start your own distillery?
Why not?
So everyone can find out all the information there.
Cool. Have you got anything else that you particularly want to bring up?
Just encouraging people to get out, drink local.
Yeah.
I think that's been one thing that's really come out of this pandemic is eating and drinking local. And so for us, when we went into level 3 the first time, we thought, shit, we're out of luck. The dream's dead. But thank you to everyone who bought our gin. And we were amazed to see how many people did go online to our shop and start going direct. And the questions that we got and the curiosity. So we're not a very big country.
Yeah.
So it's even more important to keep drinking local and supporting not just us, but your local distillery down the road or one you've been curious about. I've always said you don't just need to drink Southward, like drink everyone, drink Juno, drink Hastings, get out there and try them all so that our industry grows and that we can really make something special.
Cool. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. You're doing some awesome stuff. I'm looking forward to a dram at some point. Thanks for coming and having a chat to us.
Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time to listen to us today. Check out honeycomb.co.nz for information and links relating to this episode. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll never miss an episode.